Everybody, this is Dwayne Johnson, and I'm here to tell you about a new documentary podcast series titled What Really Happened, narrated by award-winning documentary filmmaker Andrew Jenks in coordination with our company, Seven Bucks Productions.
Muhammad Ali saved a man from committing suicide.
I got the whole world, I want
him. In 2007, Britney Spears' life became a train wreck.
Next thing I knew, all her hair was off.
Was Michael Jordan pushed out of basketball because of his gambling problem?
You know, I'm doing fine. I'm strong mentally, I'm strong physically.
Did any of these happen the way we were told? I'm Andrew Jenks, a documentary filmmaker, and along with executive producers Dwayne Johnson and Danny Garcia, I go on a rogue investigation.
This series will look deep into the unknown sides of historic news stories and then ask, what really happened?
You can subscribe and listen to What Really Happened now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I don't know if you agree with me, but it kind of feels like we've reached this sugar crash stage of the NBA season where we've now seen all of the teams. We're pretty confident that no one's nearly as good as Golden State. Things are starting to settle in a little bit, and we're trying to kind of wrap our minds around, you know, what comes next. But I need your help with something that's been bothering me for the last 2 days. Is that something that I can lean on you for?
Sure. I'm here to stall as long as possible before we have to talk about the Wizards. So whatever you need, I'm here for you.
Yeah, don't sound too excited. Thanks a lot. You know, you can't compare me to your wife on last week's episode. Now I reach my hand out, and this is what I get, a tepid response.
Going through the motions. Go for it, yeah. Man.
Fantastic. So here's what I don't quite understand, and this is something that you're guilty of, but you're not alone in being guilty of this. I mean, we rewind to last week's episode, and you started to ramp up the concern about Cleveland. And mm-hmm. I don't understand why there's a double standard for concern at this point of the season between Cleveland and between Oklahoma City. Because when I look at Oklahoma City, first of all, they're not old like Cleveland, right? So we're going to strike that excuse. They've got some new pieces for sure, but not as many new pieces as Cleveland does. They have really good health. I mean, they're not dealing with Tristan Thompson being out and Isaiah Thomas being out. They've got the reigning MVP, who you told me was really, really, really impressive last year. They have an upgraded roster with Paul George. And they have some impressive wins, albeit over, you know, pretty weak competition. So why is there like 15 or 20 times more concern from the media, including yourself, about Cleveland than there is about Oklahoma City, when Oklahoma City has a very similar record? They're outside the playoff picture currently in the Western Conference, and they've been terrible against all the good teams they've played. I mean, they really don't have a super quality win yet. You can give them Milwaukee for sure. But they've lost a lot of close games. Everyone loves to point to their amazing defense. Well, they have the worst defense in the league right now in clutch situations. Obviously, small sample size, but they're not taking care of business late. And then you look at that game against Portland the other night. That was a meltdown. You know, I mean, Westbrook goes 0-for-3 from the free throw line and then comes out, you know, is dropping profanities. Yeah, and blaming the refs. I mean, it just seems to me like there should be some concern around this team. And if there's not, then there shouldn't be nearly as much concern as there is around Cleveland. I just don't get that gap. Why does that gap exist?
Yeah, all right. So I don't know if you're sincerely asking here or really just sort of shoehorning this question in so that you can take shots at the Thunder.
It was a rhetorical question, but I would like to know your explanation.
My sincere answer would be a couple different things that make them a little bit easier to trust than the Cavs right now. Number one, the defense, clutch situations aside, the defense is really good. And I don't know the specific numbers, but last I checked, they were top five defensively. And they should be there most of the year. And I think that gives them a pretty high floor as a team and will sort of stabilize them as we go. And the offense, it makes sense that they haven't figured out crunch time. It makes sense that they are sort of working out the right balance with Paul George and Melo in there next to Russ. I don't really love Russ and never have. And yet, and every time we discuss the Thunder, you try to bait me into the MVP discussion again, and I'm not going to fall for it. But I do think that there's just, when you compare OKC to Cleveland, like OKC just has so many more weapons than the Cavs right now. So I'm not totally sure
that they do, though. I mean, I still look at that team and I agree. Defensively, they have a really high defensive ceiling, much higher than Cleveland's. There's no question. Can they sustain that consistently? And then can they do that late, knowing that they probably want to keep Melo on the court and he's a guy you can definitely pick on? Also, in terms of their clutch stuff, last year they really overperformed. You know, Westbrook was unbelievable in the clutch. Does that come back to earth? Did they overperform their record? Like, were they not quite as good as their record indicated last year? That's something that I'm worried about. Well, and then Paul George in the clutch.
The Westbrook thing is going to be really interesting to watch, because I do think that if Russ is going to continue to try to do it on his own, and there have been a couple games, one game against the T-Wolves, the game where Wiggins banked in the game winner, Russ did do it on his own and had them in a position to win. And then Melo hit a three at the end that would have sort of put them ahead to seal the game. But like, Russ took over that fourth quarter. But if that's how Russ is going to play every fourth quarter, then there will be sort of a regression and a correction compared to last year. But I think there's another way to do it, where you sort of integrate Melo down the stretch and especially integrate Paul George, that they're just sort of searching for it right now, and they'll figure it out. And that's why I'm not too stressed. Although,
but you just trust them. You have a lot of trust in these guys.
This is why I don't like talking about the Thunder, because you always turn me into like a Thunder believer. I just think that they're going to end up right around third or fourth in the West, which is where we always assumed they would be. And then there are some structural deficiencies that are going to hurt them when things get real in the second and third round of the playoffs.
All right. Contrary to your accusations, I wasn't necessarily trying to dog you out, at least not yet. That's coming. I think you stand for a lot of people in the leash you're giving them. And I guess I just question, why are we giving them a leash and not Cleveland? Because Cleveland, when they've needed to get wins, whether it was against Washington, whether it was against Milwaukee, whether it was against Boston, they have actually risen to the occasion. And I'll tell you one guy I definitely do trust in the playoffs. That's LeBron. Okay. I look at Oklahoma City. Do I trust Westbrook in the playoffs? No. Well, I'm just saying, like, which of these things should we be more concerned about? Do you trust Westbrook in the playoffs? Do you trust Paul George in the playoffs? Do you really trust Carmelo Anthony in the playoffs, knowing he's going to have to play both ways? No, I don't. And so right now, if I look at these two teams, who would I pick in a hypothetical playoff matchup between them? Obviously, they're in different conferences. To me, I would still buy into Cleveland, as bad as their defense have been, as bad as all the other indicators and body language and all of those things. If they played head-to-head, I would still trust them more than I trust Oklahoma City. And I just don't quite understand why the gap here, or conventional wisdom here, is so slanted towards the Thunder. It's just confusing to me.
That's fair. And you raised some good points. Should we talk about the Cavs now? Cavs Wizards?
I mean, this is what I've been waiting for 4 days. You know, it's kind of crazy, because I don't totally know when to call for the emergency podcast. Every time the Wizards take a bad loss, I want to call for one, because you're raging in my text messages and my brain is just going like 3 speed, like 3x in terms of like things to make fun of you for the loss. Obviously, we're talking about that Cavaliers versus Wizards game. I mean, do you want to set the stage? You were there.
Yes. And I should add that I'm really glad that we didn't have a podcast that night, because I would have said a number of things that I would have regretted. So it's for the best that we've had a couple days here where I can cool off. We got a number of questions in the wake of that game. I'll read two here, both from Cavs fans. Justin said, "I just don't understand why Sharp's Wizards felt the need to poke the bear. The Cavs were slumping and needed motivation for a win, and Washington gave it to them. 57-11 was otherworldly, and the Wizards have nobody to blame but themselves." And then Spencer says, "I'm a lifelong Cavs fan who's grown up with LeBron. While I'm tempted to ask some snarky question as retaliation for the seemingly endless onslaught of Cavs concern trolling I've endured, I have a different question. How much does this loss hurt the mental state and confidence of the Wizards?" Good points from Justin. And as far as Spencer's question, I was in a really dark place Friday night. And let me also say, This is the last time we're discussing the goddamn Wizards until at least Christmas, okay? Because I'm sick of talking about them. I was so mad at the Wizards after that Cavs game, and I did not even enjoy LeBron's 57 because, at least half of the 57 points came on layups, and the Wizards were just so half-assed and sloppy the entire night. And then Scott Brooks comes into the press conference and starts talking about just how great LeBron was. Gotta tip your cap. You know, some nights you just can't do anything. And it's like, that's bullshit. Okay. That's a loser's mentality. And that's what the Wizards have had for decades. And, yes, LeBron was great in the fourth quarter. He kind of took over and that was phenomenal. But a guy gets into a rhythm if you're just going to give up layups for the first three quarters. And LeBron aside, Derrick Rose went off for, 21 points in the first quarter. Like, John Wall single-handedly rejuvenated his career on Friday night. And I don't know, man. I don't want to be too negative with the Wizards, but as far as, the mental state and confidence of the Wizards, I think Spencer was referring to the idea that LeBron is some sort of mountain that they can't climb and is in their head. It, for me watching the game, it was not about LeBron. It was about the Wizards just being disorganized and their defense was somehow worse than the Cavs, who the Cavs for the first couple weeks of the season have played worse defense than I've ever seen over the last few years. And the Wizards kind of one-upped them, and a lot of it is Wall. And so as far as the mental state and of the Wizards, I think my problem watching that game was me sitting there wondering, maybe these are, habits that are just never going to get fixed. And a lot of it comes back to Wall, where, he's got to kind of dial in a little bit more than he has. And the other thing I was thinking of was, we've made fun of Reggie Jackson a lot on this podcast, and maybe it's karma, but Wall has played a lot like Reggie Jackson for the first month, and it's just, all of it's unacceptable. They are bitching to officials incessantly, and I don't know, man. It was just a really dark night. So what did you see?
I have so many things to come back at you with. First of all, I look forward to LeBron getting 60 against the Wizards next time, so you'll finally give him some credit. That's number one. Unbelievable trying to say, oh, it's all the Wizards. Get out of town.
No. Look, I've given LeBron has owned the Wizards for most of my life as a basketball fan. I didn't really start caring until the Gilbert years, and then LeBron just started dominating the Wizards then, and it's continued for about 10 years. So I have seen all kinds of different performances where LeBron has emasculated my favorite basketball team. That one, the Wizards did it to themselves on Friday night. That they lost that game in the first half, and then LeBron was scoring on Jody Meeks and John Wall in the fourth quarter. Congrats. That's awesome. LeBron's amazing. I'm not trying to take shots at him, but
okay, the next reaction I have here is that I tried to warn you about this a week or two ago, where we had the self-awareness conversation. You remember that, where I was like, look, you have to kind of put a little distance between yourself and these guys because they might go out there and embarrass you in public. I believe I compared them to my grandfather who, kind of took us to the handicap bathroom when we shouldn't have been in the handicap bathroom, and it was awkward. You didn't show a lot of self-awareness on last week's episode. I mean, right before this big game, you're basically saying how Cleveland's a lot worse than everyone's saying, that you're pushing back against the people who are saying everything's okay. You walked right into it, just like the Wizards, mind you. I mean, what have we been clowning the Wizards themselves for? It's all this big chest-thumping talk and then not delivering, right? I mean, they're kind of like the Washington rubber bullets. They pop off a lot, but they really couldn't harm a fly. And you contributed to that. And I just don't understand how that happened, because you had the fair warning. I mean, you had 10 years of past history telling you LeBron was going to punk you. And then you basically begged for LeBron to punk you, and then he punked you, and now you're not really giving him credit for punking you, and you're basically asking him to do it again. I just don't understand that chain of events logically, Andrew.
It's not that I'm not giving him credit, all right? He's great. I'm just so mad at the Wizards that I can't even appreciate anything that he's doing. And
aren't you a little mad at yourself, though? I mean, some of these emails were coming in and basically blaming you for the loss. Did any of those register at all? I mean, I'm teasing you because I know that one really hurt, and I'm just kind of yanking your chain a little bit. But do you feel slightly responsible, like maybe you got caught up in the hype just a little bit too much last week?
I don't know, because I think if you're making fun of the Wizards, you're making fun of a lack of self-awareness. And if you go back to last week's podcast, I did preface my Wizards optimism by saying this is sad and this is dangerous, but I do think that the Wizards are making the finals. And it's both sad and dangerous. And if you flip it around after Friday night, like, the rubber bullets is good. I was thinking, like, John Wall has been calling it wolf season. You could call this Wizards crying wolf season.
Nice. I like it. I like where you're going.
I thought of writing a really angry Wizards column called crying wolf season, decided against that one. But in general, I think it's a game in like early November, so it shouldn't matter. The only reason it did matter to me is because I had this like flash watching that game being like, wow, so the Wizards are just never going to figure out how to be like a competent team that doesn't shoot itself in the foot every time something good's about to happen. I can't stress how kind of shitty Wall has been to start the year, which caught me off guard. And I just hope, like, I hope they figure it out. I do think that they still have the talent to make the finals. But I like Friday night was just awful because that game happened. And then I went home and watched the Celtics, a competent, less talented organization or less talented team go beat the Thunder. And I was just like, man, so this is just going to be my life. Watching the Wizards like piss away the prime of like three. I mean, Wall and Beal are legitimate all-stars. Otto's getting there, and yet they're just sort of getting in their own way. So all I will say is that going forward, I am going to take your advice, take a couple steps away from this team, and we'll revisit it at Christmas. But right now I need a break, and I hope that like Wall starts to get into a little bit more of a rhythm and they get rolling. But I'm not going to be out there repping the Wizards as they like talk shit and play like Reggie Jackson.
Well, I love that you reach the same conclusion as Marcin Gortat, who said after the Raptors win that it was time for Washington to be a little bit more humble. Oh, yeah. Good conclusion. Yeah. So glad you reached that one. Hey, I mean, you kind of gave LeBron credit. You said you did, but I'm going to give him real credit. I thought that game against Washington was the closest to a Mike impersonation, like a late career Mike impersonation as anyone I've seen. Kobe Bryant included, by the way. First of all, what you said about Washington's defense was dead on. I mean, why are they not sending help on LeBron the 16th time he's backing down John Wall for like a 75 to 80% shot that he's getting every single time on the block?
Shoot, and yet they refused to double team him. And LeBron was openly making fun of them after the game. But so
as he should have. It was terrible. I mean, just so bad. No adjustment whatsoever. That's on the coaches and the players too. But LeBron going to the block and hitting the turnarounds over both shoulders, creating that separation, was a preview of 40-year-old LeBron. I can't wait. You know, I mean, yes, you always call me like Grandpa Gulliver on the text messages claiming how old I am. Well, I am definitely here for the 2025 revival of MJ's, you know, turnaround over the shoulder, you know, just money mid-range jumpers. That will work in any era, as LeBron proved. I thought it was a spectacular night from him all around, but it goes back to the point I was trying to make last week, and then I ended up putting into a column, which is this. You know, LeBron can really ramp it up, and he can beat just about everyone. He can punk a team like the Wizards that really thinks it's special. But that type of game is not going to be enough to take down Golden State. And I'm not even sure if that would be enough to beat a team like Houston or San Antonio once they get right in the finals. LeBron needs, and he might be in the process of it right now, but he needs to admit that at this stage of his career, as he approaches his next free agency decision, that he needs more help than he has needed in the past. He needs to rethink his entire approach to like leverage, and I'm going to keep my organization guessing, and I'm going to be on these short-term contracts, and I want to max out every single dollar that I can get. If he is serious about trying to add to his championship ring total, you know, just turning it up once every 2 weeks to prove that you're still the best all-around player, you know, during the regular season, to me, it's not the best formula that's out there. I mean, this guy should be playing 30 minutes a night, maybe 32, lower usage, taking care of his body, still winning games because he has enough support around him, whether that's support from the coaching staff, whether that's support from his teammates, whether that's support from a better organization. And right now, those things are lacking in Cleveland. So as amazing of an individual effort as that was, I thought it really was just a continuation of all the concerns we'd had up to this point of the season, which is, you know, LeBron doesn't really have enough help here, and he needs to figure out how he can get into that situation. I really think his best move next summer is to pick the organization that gives him the best chance to compete consistently, an organization with a coach and a general manager and an ownership group that he trusts, sign a multi-year, whether it's 3 or 4 year contract, lock in so that he can become a recruiting chip for the front office to do its work. Maybe take a discount. Maybe take a discount money-wise so they can divvy it up a little bit. That could mean go to Houston, play with guys like Harden and Chris Paul. That could mean go into San Antonio, and maybe you don't have to sacrifice. You can get a third star with him and Kawhi Leonard. I mean, there are ways to do this, but I think he really needs to rethink his approach here, because if he continues down the same path of, I'm the alpha and the omega, I'm always the answer for my team, it will make for some fun games, you know, against the weaker sisters of the East, like the Washington Wizards. It's going to leave him wanting more when he gets to the finals level.
Yeah, that's all true. You know, I don't think anybody who would have come out of that Cavs-Wizards game beating their chest saying, see, the Cavs are fine, did not have very long to beat their chest, because the Hawks game sort of brought us right back to square one with that
Great
team.
Point. And, great point.
You know, it's fine. We'll see. This is going to be a really interesting chapter with LeBron, and you're right. That was like seeing him turn on MJ mode was great, and he was great afterwards. He didn't even say anything about all the Wizards trash talk leading up to it. Like, he didn't really even dignify it, because the game said everything he needed to say. And it was
cool.
Yeah,
no, that's
respect.
The dust your shoulder off approach. You know, Jay-Z used to rap about that. I mean, you're the dust in this analogy.
Yeah, there's no question that the Wizards and me are the dust. Yeah, no, it'll be interesting to see where it goes. Like, Isaiah was warming up and actually like moving around on the basketball court before the game, and you know, who knows when he comes back, and he could change the equation for them a little bit. But I the one thing I won't take back from Friday's pod is I am still pretty worried about the Cavs just in general. But if you're a Cavs fan, like, you still get another year watching LeBron in like GOAT mode, so that'll be fun. And I'm glad. Thank you for giving me space to vent about the Wizards. And that's the last time we'll discuss it.
No, I was glad to do that. I thought you handled that pretty well. I think even our listeners and emailers to openfloormail@gmail.com, who were just roasting you all weekend long, I think they'll be satisfied with how you handled that too.
Just don't become the East Coast Clippers, okay? With the trash talk and with the complaining to the refs, like, I don't want to root for the East Coast Clippers. That's all I ask.
Hey, here's a question, kind of unrelated. Were you able to enjoy that game? I always wonder, because you got a really historic game. I mean, that's LeBron's second most points in a regular season game of his entire career. Like I said, the best Mike impression I've probably ever seen in my life. Or did it just hurt too bad?
No, I was, again, just too upset. Too upset, like, on Friday.
Even
night.
With like the 48 hours of space, you can't look back and be like, yeah, I was at that game. It just, it's one that you're just going to dump from the hard drive.
No, and again, there have been other games through the years where I, like, the Wizards have had no answer for LeBron, and I've been able to just enjoy him putting on a show. But this year, like, there's enough real success that's possible for the Wizards that, like, the screw ups matter now and are actually upsetting. But let's move on to a game that I did enjoy and that you enjoyed as well. Kristaps Porzingis, Sunday night against the Pacers. I have no idea why I was even watching Pacers Knicks Sunday at 10 o'clock, but it was incredible. So Chase asks, Porzingis has been amazing over the start of the season. What does this mean for the Knicks moving forward? They clearly blew it by not trading Carmelo before last season, and it seems like they may have missed their tanking window. I don't know. I think they might still be able to tank. But he continues. He says, is Porzingis going to be good enough to make New York a top free agent destination, or will this turn into a Dirk situation where they might be able to assemble useful pieces to remain competitive but never land those top-level guys? What do you think?
Well, do you remember when Kyrie Irving put out his list of desired teams and randomly the Knicks were on it? And everyone's just like, why are the Knicks on this list? This is crazy. And then it was like, oh, well, it's the hometown team. Everybody kind of laughed about that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a team that had Kyrie and Kristaps Porzingis on it? Like, if he had gone there instead of Boston, like, how watchable and how insane would that team be for the next 5, 6, or 7 years? I was just, you know, mulling that over the last 48 hours, and my mind, you know, kind of half exploded.
Yeah, basically, imagine everything that Kyrie is doing with Horford, except with Porzingis. Like, Porzingis can do everything that Horford's doing. I guess he's probably not as gifted a passer at this point, but it would be, over the summer, nobody thought Kristaps had this level in him this soon. I think that's why everybody was sort of scratching their heads on that one.
Well, I will not claim that I thought he was going to be like a top 3 or 4 scorer in the league.
Yeah.
And we'll see if he can hold that up. But I did tell you he was going to like getting buckets. I mean,
I told you, man?
He was going to be the guy who wants to be the face of the Knicks franchise. He seems to be loving life just a little bit, don't you think?
You were so right about that. And I apologize to you.
I believe you called that one of my worst takes ever.
I
don't know where that came from. I was so stunned when you said that. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure a guy like Porzingis with his skills, I mean, he grew up, you know, kind of idolizing all these scoring type guys. Now he's got the green light. Why wouldn't he love that?
Well, I just envisioned him getting like 25 points a game, going like 7 for 20 from the field, and the Knicks losing by double digits every night. And in that, there are a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is I'm not sure Jeff Hornacek is actually a good coach. And then you look at the guys that the Knicks were coming into the season with who were going to be getting him the ball, like Jared Jack, Ramon Sessions, Ronnie Baker. Like, I don't know, it just looked kind of bleak. But I think part of what has caught me off guard with Porzingis early on is that, like, he's able to create so much by himself. It basically, like, if you just throw him the ball, he's been able to create off the dribble more than I thought he would, and it just hasn't really mattered. He's been enough to keep them in games by himself. Like, against the Pacers, his plus minus was in the 30s. Like, he was plus 30, I think. And they were down 18 or 19 to Indiana late in the third, and he just kind of turned it on and nothing else mattered. Which, again, that's like a different level of player.
Yeah, for sure. The first time I saw Porzingis play live was at Summer League, and my very first takeaway was that he moved like a basketball player, not somebody who was forced to play basketball. That's always like a key distinction, especially when you're talking about bigs, and especially when you're talking about European bigs. He moves like a basketball player. I mean, it's as simple as you could say it. And now he's working on his handle, like you're saying. Now he's got the craft with the footwork. Now he's really sizing up people and going one-on-one. And his length is an asset in so many different ways. We tend to focus on length as a defensive skill, I think, just because you could see the rim protection. You could see what a difference it makes to have that extra wingspan, yeah, like for Porzingis compared to a guy like Towns, where to me, Towns is like kind of playing at rim level, whereas players like Porzingis or Rudy Gobert, they're just so much longer, so much more sweeping in their defensive movements just because of the wingspan. But it's an asset offensively too. I mean, his release points when he's, you know, driving hard across the paint, how are you going to block that shot? You know, you're just not. And same thing when he's going to his turnarounds, or same thing when he's going to, you know, up and unders. I mean, he's just able to get the ball to places that defensive guys in one-on-one situations are not expecting the ball to be able to get to. And he looks very comfortable. He's coming to his own. His confidence is through the roof. I love it. To me, it's a better version of what we saw early last year when he was starting to show some of those all-star glimpses. And I just really hope he can sustain it. You know, some of the, you know, the other shoe could drop. You know, that could still happen in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, there could still be some of those double-digit losses where it's harder. His efficiency takes a hit and he's not having as much fun as he is right now. But if you're a Knicks fan, or if you're Porzingis, or you're the people close to Porzingis, you've got to be elated with how this start has gone, because given all of the turnover this summer, I mean, it could have gotten really, really ugly coming out of the gate, given how many new pieces and inexperienced pieces they're going to be playing. The other thing I'd say about Porzingis is it's kind of all happening here, because I don't know if you saw his brother give the interview, you know, over in, I believe it was in Latvia, where he was essentially saying, like, look, we want the Knicks to pull this together, you know, essentially hinting that maybe he would, you know, either take the qualifying offer on his rookie contract in a couple years so that he could become an unrestricted free agent, or, you know, somehow in a different manner kind of flex his ability to work his way out of New York if they didn't really rebuild quickly around him.
Right.
I have to say I love that because that's what we were kind of calling on Devin Booker to do, right? And I think this is the next stage of the trickle-down of, like, player empowerment, which we've seen from veteran guys increasingly in recent years. Mm-hmm. There's going to be these real standout guys who are instant impact players on their rookie deals. And if their organizations don't have their stuff together, if Phoenix is just constantly firing coaches and just cycling the roster and getting into these disputes with other players, you know, at some point, a guy like Devin Booker should just be like, you know what? I'm good. I don't care if I'm supposed to be here for 7 years. I don't want to be here. I'm going to find a way out. And you could say the same thing about Porzingis. You know, I mean, I think that he really has quite a bit of leverage over that organization. And I've seen a lot of people online say, well, oh, guys always sign the rookie extensions. It would be crazy if he didn't sign. It would be such a huge, gigantic risk. As long as he's healthy, the money is going to be there. And I think those guys know that. And so I would just love to see how this is going to play out in terms of New York's other moves to build around him. Who do they go after? Who wants to play with him? And then what happens if they really can't upgrade this roster quickly? Does he continue to make these kinds of statements, whether it's through his brother or, you know, his other representation, about, you know, maybe wanting a different place? As crazy as that sounds, because he seems like he would be the toast of New York, you know, the Big Apple's favorite son. I don't think it's, you know, too early to start that, given that his people have already put that out there.
Okay, all right. But it's not too early to start that, but I'm not going to let you start that this week. In part because this is the most hope Knicks fans have had for like the last 3 years, and we can't ruin that by wondering whether maybe Porzingis should force his way out of New York. So let's just let them live. Because I do think the other thing, like, is the question here is, Porzingis good enough to make New York a top free agent destination? I think the answer to that is yes. If this continues and he can sustain it over the course of the next 6 months and maybe the next year or two, absolutely somebody like Kyrie is going to want to come play in New York.
Interesting though,
what
let me run this by you, because no one's wanted to go play with AD in New Orleans. Like, that's not been a thing, right?
Well, that's a different thing though. I mean, first of all, New Orleans isn't New York. Second of all, the New Orleans organization is an absolute shit show, and not that the Knicks aren't that, but I do think people are willing to look past certain red flags to play in the Garden on a team that can actually, like, contend. And I think Porzingis is certainly a centerpiece that puts them in that conversation of teams that, like, are going to be in a position to leverage the next or to go grab the next unhappy star.
Nothing screams, functional organization like James Dolan. But I guess my point was less about comparing the two franchises, because you're right, there are extenuating circumstances about who wants to go to New Orleans. And clearly the history factor there is way in favor of the Knicks, and the glamour factor and the market factor and all of that. But
yeah,
do big guys attract people who want to play with them, knowing that your primary job is just to feed the big, right? Like, if I was just a random NBA player personally, and I know this is going to sound like crazy bias because I've really been sucking on Giannis's teat, as that one as that one emailer accused me of a few weeks ago, I would personally rather go play with Giannis than Porzingis because of the playmaking factor. You know, I'm going to be touching the ball more. The ball is going to move. I'm not going to be just feeding, an alpha scorer. And that's not a knock on Porzingis. You know, I think he's going to probably improve as a playmaker, especially as he starts to see more and more double teams. He is going to get good in sort of like a LaMarcus Aldridge type way of, like, you know, timing those passes out to find the shooters. I mean, that's definitely going to be something that we just take for granted from Porzingis in like 2 years, right? But strictly from a style of play standpoint, do you want to get up and down with a point center, a point guard, whatever you want to call Giannis, who is going to keep you involved and attract a lot of attention and find you play in, play out? Or do you want to, play with a big like Porzingis where you're feeding him and it's more of a one-way relationship? Again, that's not a knock on Porzingis. Yeah. I think that's just a fact of NBA basketball. I think it's harder to convince guys who want to touch the ball and have their touches and have their shots to go do it with a big who's going to be a high usage player.
That is a very fair point. Although, again, I think that the prospect of playing in New York would mitigate that to some degree. Like, would you rather play with Giannis, which is a slightly better basketball situation for another superstar, or play in New York with Porzingis?
I care about titles. Despite New York's amazing vegetarian food options, I want to play for titles. I think Giannis has a slightly better chance at getting titles at this point than Porzingis, but that gap closed quick. I mean, we got to give Porzingis a lot of credit here. He has had a great breakout.
Yeah, and this is the problem with the Knicks. It's like they do anything well, and suddenly idiots like me start talking about the mystique of MSG and the New York market and how they're going to draw superstars. So we should definitely just chill out here. The other thing I wanted to mention that is part of what made that Pacers game so cool for Knicks fans and the Knicks guys I've talked to in the last 24 hours. French Frank looked pretty good. He looked solid. Like, if he could be a 3-and-D guy who could just hit open threes off of Porzingis kickouts, like, that is actually a really useful piece for them. And we'll see whether he can sustain it. But it was definitely, like, part of what made the Pacers game such a fever dream for Knicks fans. It's like, wow, like, Porzingis is the next Dirk. Frank is not a complete bust, and we can do some things. I did want to ask one other question here. It's something that we had discussed last week offline, and then we got a number of emails today, Monday, comparing Porzingis to some of the other unicorns. So who is on the 2025 banana boat if we're drawing from the unicorns around the league? I would say, I think both of us agree that Giannis is LeBron of the 2025 banana boat. But where do you put Kristaps?
Yeah, I mean, he is really, really hard to comp. First of all, he is a legit unicorn. I was kind of clowning Towns for not having the tail and only having the horn. Kristaps has both. I mean, this guy is an impact player offensively and defensively. His paint presence is really something. He does struggle to kind of get out and defend. I mean, it seems like Hornacek, half his job is just to scream at Porzingis to close out on shooters, which probably gets really old for both of them.
Right.
I do feel a little sympathy there. Last thing on Porzingis, too. It reminds me of Giannis last year. I mean, it seems like he's already locked up most improved player here. Within the first 2 weeks of the season. If anyone besides Porzingis wins that award, I would be very, very surprised. I'm not sure that Porzingis has a comp. I think he is looking at a situation where his ceiling, like he could be better than Dirk, you know? And people during the pre-draft process got really mad about those comparisons and said, that's not fair. Any player in that situation, why couldn't he be better than Dirk? You know, and when I look at the careers of guys like, you know, Chris Paul, you know, Dwayne Wade, the other Carmelo Anthony, I mean, are any of those guys on the same level historically as Dirk? I mean, maybe Wade.
I think Wade is sort of in that same area. Probably not as like historically respected as Dirk. Like Dirk will probably in part because he was so revolutionary to like international players coming over here and the idea that they could lead franchises. But I think Kristaps is in the Wade spot, and then we'd have to put Cat in the Melo spot because of the defense, which you threw that out there, and I haven't been able to get it out of my mind watching him the last week or two.
Yeah, the Cat Melo comparisons. I mean, part of it is like is really complimentary actually, because you look at like offensive craft. I mean, you know, Cat for his generation is going to have a level of craft and polish that even Porzingis, if he continues to improve, I don't really see him getting to that level. But I think he's also going to have limitations physically on the defensive end that are kind of Melo-esque. I think he's ultimately going to have a better impact defensively just because of his position. Like Cat's defensive ceiling at his peak is going to be higher than Melo's was.
And it's hard to imagine that he stays this bad forever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, young guys, they constantly improve. We're just a little confused why it's taken him. Why it's been so gradual in terms of his progress. I also love, we got an email from a Cat defender. I want to say he was Australian because, of course, he was. All of our emails are Australian, kind of defending Minnesota's like recent defensive improvement. And obviously, Jimmy being back is a factor in that. But then I went to go check like their last game. They had played Dallas, which is like their offense is hopeless. Like you could definitely start for Dallas on the wing. And I was thinking, oh, well, that's why Minnesota's defense all of a sudden looks so spectacular. No one's out there exploiting Cat. Yeah, I think Cat and Melo is a comparison. Giannis and LeBron is the obvious one. I'm not sure that these other unicorns really deserve to be on the boat.
Do we
though.
Have a Chris Paul?
I don't know. Who are you trying to throw out there for it?
I don't. I keep coming back to Boogie for Chris Paul, in part because everybody sort of loathes both of them, like teammates. And the problem is that Chris Paul is so good and has been for so long. And Boogie is not as like surgical, certainly. But I also like it because Boogie and Chris Paul, like, I think hate each other more than any two players in the NBA right now.
And so I used to hand out flop of the year like 3 years ago. Chris Paul took home the title for that egregious flop he had on Boogie, where he basically ran into him and then jumped off of him and fell down and actually succeeded. And Boogie got so, so mad about that.
It's one of my favorite subplots of the NBA. Anytime those two play, there's just all kinds of bullshit going on between the both of them. And it's been like that for like 5 years.
Look, I'll admit I'm not doing a great job on this banana boat comparison.
I'm expecting a little bit more imagination and buy-in from you, but it's fine. It's fine. You were the one who raised it.
I can comp players to national parks a little bit more effectively. But one thing I do like about you mentioning DeMarcus, I would love to see him take a page out of Chris Paul's book in terms of really flexing his influence on choosing his next destination. Because I've watched New Orleans, quite a bit early on, and some people are putting them way at the top of the watchability. I saw people do that before the season, and I've seen that kind of maintain. To me, that team has not been that fun to watch. I mean, Boogie has been incredible. There's no question about it. He has been really, really impressive. But the holes that existed, the questions that were there, have kind of come to fruition, more or less like we expected. They're not lighting the world on fire. And I think DeMarcus is at a very unique point of his career here, heading into the trade deadline. He's never made the playoffs. We can't underscore and underline that enough, right? Yeah. He has a chance here to absolutely take control of his own career and ensure that he makes the playoffs. If they get to February and they're still kind of like putzing around like, 10th, 11th in the West, and they're not clearly in that position, he needs to say, you know what, Anthony Davis? I didn't ask to be traded here. I tried to make it work. I know it's not even been a year yet, but I have to do me. You know, I have to go out there and get myself into a situation, traded to a team that actually has a playoff future. We tried. It didn't work out. Very similar to how Chris, you know, this summer basically engineered that trade to Houston, making sure that he was going to have a chance to really play for a top contender, right? I don't want Boogie just to be like, hey, I'm having a good time here in New Orleans with my Kentucky buddy AD, and we're playing this, you know, crazy style where we're both on the perimeter and no one else is really doing this like twin towers on the perimeter thing, and we're putting up numbers, so I'm just going to be happy with it. We need playoff DeMarcus. I've been waiting way too long to see what he can do in a playoff series. And so from that standpoint, I want him to keep, you know, his foot on the pedal here and not get comfortable, because it would be a real shame if we were denied both AD and Cousins in the playoffs again. And there's a possibility that New Orleans will make it. I wouldn't necessarily bet on it. I'm not writing them off yet. I'm just saying once February comes, he should be proactive in terms of, you know, using his leverage and his influence, because all he has to do is tell New Orleans, you know what, this didn't work out. I don't want to be here next summer. Trade me, and they will have to trade him.
I appreciate it. It's a good case from you, and I owe you some belated props, because you wrote that in a column a couple weeks ago, and it was the night Boogie had gone back to Sacramento and was just incredible and willed them to win pretty much by himself. And I think the Pelicans had won a game earlier in the week, and there was a lot of enthusiasm surrounding like what was possible for Boogie and the Pelicans. Like Boogie was playing out of his mind. And then Friday morning comes and you drop the column basically being like, great game last night from Boogie. He needs to get out of New Orleans. He needs to demand a trade as soon as possible. And I laughed out loud when I saw it. And I was really proud of you. And thank you for being your ruthless self at all times and never...
Well, look, you're putting words into my mouth a little bit. I just think that he needs to really look at this from his entire career standpoint. How many years is too many years?
You're not wrong. I'm not saying like you're 100% dead on. He should sort of take ownership and force his way to a situation that makes sense. It was just,
and by the
timing was really inspired from you on that one.
Well, the timing was when it mattered, because, you know, that was his best game of the year, but AD's not out. AD wasn't playing that game. AD doesn't play a lot of games. You know, if you're a Boogie, you already made the mistake of trusting an organization to like surround you with teammates and being patient, and he got burned by it. He got traded without really his foreknowledge during the All-Star game. That was ridiculous. And he claimed that he had learned the lesson from that of basically, you know, it's a business, there is no loyalty. And it's one thing to learn a lesson, it's another to apply it to your own life. And all I'm saying is, you know, take that same lesson from the Sacramento experience and be ready to apply it if and when it's necessary at the trade deadline. That was my only point. I wasn't trying to rain on their parade. I mean, he was phenomenal in that game. Yeah.
Yeah, you were right. It was a good point. Let's move on to a couple more questions here before we hit the podium. Chris says, my question, let's assume Kawhi comes back 100%. I'm interested in how he ranks in your mind versus other Hall of Fame wings. What would your draft order be out of current Kawhi at 100%, prime Clyde Drexler, prime Tracy McGrady, prime Pippen? Do you have an order from those four?
I do. It's really hard with the old guys, though, to just pick the prime, because you tend to think of their like entire body of work.
Yeah.
And so that's where it gets kind of tricky. I think I would take prime Pippen first. I think I would take, assuming that Kawhi comes back even better than he was last year, I would be very tempted to take him second. Then I would go Drexler. Then I would go McGrady. I'm sure you're not surprised that I left the bucket getter with no postseason resume as my fourth pick. I'm sure your order is probably McGrady one, but that's the difference between
us. You know
us.
What? It really is. My answer is T-Mac number one, because fuck everybody. Because I have a soft spot for T-Mac, and he's my first choice regardless. And my number two, I think I would take Kawhi. I don't know. It's really, really bold to take Kawhi over Scottie Pippen. Well, that's the thing. If prime Pippen playing today would play a lot like Kawhi and would have a better 3-point stroke and would be able to fit perfectly with where the game is. So I'll say Pippen number two, Kawhi number three, and Drexler number four. But the main reason we included this is because it is completely bizarre that Kawhi is still hurt. It should be a bigger story, basically. Kawhi is still hurt. Nobody has any idea what's wrong with him. I mean, this is someone who's basically on the same level as Kevin Durant, and he just like hasn't shown up for the season, and everybody's like, oh, well, that's the Spurs. Like, he'll come back when he's ready. Like, can you imagine?
Well, slow down. He's not on the same level as Kevin Durant, because Kevin Durant's number two on SI's top 100, and Kawhi was number four. So he's close. But you're right. And remember, I was one of those people who was guilty of it. I was like, look, they're going to lose two games. They're going to bring Kawhi back. It'll be fine. They proceeded immediately after I said that to lose three straight games, and they did not bring Kawhi back. So that theory got torpedoed, straight out of the water.
Yeah, I just have no idea what's happening. I want to know more. And again, like, this is one of the three or four best players of the generation. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to call him like a generational figure, but like, because he hasn't really done it yet. Like, he started a hint at becoming that player last year, and we just haven't seen it for like an extended stretch of 3 or 4 years. But it looked like that's where things were going, and now nobody has any idea what's going on. And so just throwing that out there to remind everybody that the Kawhi situation in San Antonio is fucking bizarre.
Okay, I have two things I need to add to this conversation. Honestly, neither one of them is Kawhi related, because I think you covered it pretty much perfectly. The first is, do you remember when we brainstormed guys who you could dribble the ball across half court against? And I think our list was like Boban, Mozgov. I mean, it was like the dregs of society, NBA society. The number one player who you could definitely not dribble the ball across half court against is Scottie Pippen. And so just on behalf of Pippen and Pippen fans everywhere, I just want to say you underrated him on your list. There's no doubt about it. Also, I would like to say that if he came up in the modern NBA, early in his career, the shot wasn't necessarily his biggest strong suit. I kind of wonder if they would have tried to turn him into like a Ben Simmons, Giannis type point forward, like if he didn't ever have Jordan.
Yeah.
And maybe his handle wasn't quite good enough, but with the size and with, you know, he had some pretty good passing ability, at least as he developed. I mean, he was one of those guys who just really improved every single year of his career, like the first 5 or 6 years. I'm wondering if like somebody would have tried to make him like the focal point of an offense where he was sort of like a point forward. I mean, maybe, maybe not, but
yeah, no, I think
it's an interesting thought experiment.
Well, and also, when I was drafting 2 minutes ago, and I hadn't really thought that much about it beyond taking Tracy McGrady number one, one of the reasons Pippen, I think, probably would be number two on my list is because he's like the closest analog to Draymond, and his ability to guard all five positions. And I think like he would have been able to play down low too, in addition to locking people down on the perimeter, and just like the crazy flexibility that he would afford any team in this era would make him even more valuable than he was. And as it stands, like, he still is probably one of the most underrated players in NBA history. And to me, like, he's easily top 30, maybe even higher than that.
Now I'm getting nervous where you put McGrady in your top 30, but let's just move on before we like we start screaming, because I guarantee you that is one of those guys that we would have argued about for months if he was in his prime, and we would have had long, long conversations about the pro T-Mac or anti-T-Mac side of the aisle.
Today's show is brought to you by Movement Watches. Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. With over 1 million watches sold to customers in more than 160 countries around the world, Movement Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. Ben, it's the holiday season. Talk to me about Movement Watches.
Welcome back to our old friend Movement Watches, MVMT Watches. Andrew, you know I've had a Movement Watch for a long time. What I love about them, they start under $100, but they look like a $400, $500, or $600 watch you might get at the department store. People are always complimenting me about my Movement Watch. And the reason why it's so cheap, they just cut out all the middlemen, all those shady watch middlemen out there, poof, disappeared. Movement Watches go straight from the factory to your wrist, just like you and me go straight from the recording studio to our listeners' ears. It's the same business model. It's perfect, efficient. I love it.
Yeah, man. And it is seriously, a watch is a good gift for just about anyone in your family, and they're all under $100. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmt.com/floor. That's mvmt.com/floor. Check them out. They're good watches. One more question here. David says, has anyone made this take yet? Is Lonzo Ball just a shorter Ben Simmons? First of all, David, you don't make takes. You craft takes.
Hey,
you handcraft takes.
Hey, slow down. English might not be his first language. We're open floor globe, okay?
That's
I think
true.
Sometimes we get some emails where the verb usage is a little strange, and you just got to chalk that up. You know, they're trying. Like, they're talking our language. If we tried to speak Lithuanian or half these other languages
point.
That we hear from people, we would sound like morons. So
okay.
Go easy on David.
Fair enough. Fair enough. What do you think of Lonzo? Well, it's time for a quick Lonzo update here.
Well, he really hasn't gotten the shot going. I mean, is that where the comparison's coming from? Basically, David's just saying he can't shoot, but he's a good passer, so therefore he's Ben Simmons.
Yeah. And if Lonzo were 6'10 or 6'11, we need to have a longer Ben Simmons conversation on Friday, but we don't have time for it right now. But yeah, like the Lonzo shooting stuff continues to be an issue, but the Lakers are actually playing pretty well. And like, I think that everybody should just kind of chill on Lonzo and see where we are in like 4 or 5 months. But I don't know if that's possible with him.
Yeah, I think that the Lakers in general should be pretty much thrilled with how their start's gone. You know, they're near 500. That wasn't necessarily a guarantee. They have gotten progress from a lot of key guys, including your favorite, you know, BFF, Brandon Ingram. And Lonzo has struggled. It hasn't translated to like major team-wide struggles. And I think he's, to a certain degree, if there wasn't so many other great rookies, I'm not sure he would be catching as much heat as he has.
Yeah.
And I think that we're seriously looking at a situation now, especially with like French Frank coming up. If he becomes a player his rookie year, I mean, this has got to be the best rookie class overall performance in terms of instant impact in what, like a decade? I mean, there was entire years where we didn't have one guy who could really put up numbers in the entire class and hold on to starting minutes. And we've got like 10 or 15 guys this year.
We've got 10 or 15 guys who would have won the rookie of the year last year, which is how I've thought about it, is like any one of these guys would have been like worshipped last year. Even someone like John Collins in Atlanta is lights out compared to what we were seeing from like Dario Saric this time last year. Saric picked it up as the year went on, but like there really are like 10 to 15 guys who have been incredible. And it's one of the things, like, especially with the Warriors dominating at the top of the league, it like watching rookies every night and talking about them and seeing where they're going, how they might develop, like, that's another subplot that is sort of like filling the intrigue void, which I'm grateful for.
Yeah, and part of the reason why I brought that up is because, you know, we are used to rookies taking 2 to 3 years to find their shooting stroke, right? Like the D'Angelo Russell model is actually like fairly accurate, right? Like by year three, he looks like kind of a competent player who can consistently put up good offensive numbers this year.
Yeah,
Lonzo, you know, 10 games in. It doesn't surprise me that with that really ugly shooting stroke, he hasn't been able to hit anything from outside. I think there's a really good chance he's going to have to rework that at some point, and that could, you know, be very controversial and ugly and a strained process. I don't know when that's going to happen. but I'm not going to write off his inability to shoot until he's like 22. You know,
no, he shouldn't be written off.
And that's a long wait.
He shouldn't be written off, but I will say that it's kind of insane the way the Lakers talk about him and market him, and like even Lakers writers talk about him as if he's this like transcendent figure, and you shouldn't do that with a rookie who's shooting 20% of from the field. Why?
Because everyone's got access to click analytics. It's all based on, you know, who drives page views. You know,
I guess so.
If
I'm
writers,
saying, I'm talking about the team itself. The team shouldn't be like encouraging that. Like they should sort of.
Why not? He's selling tickets. You know, he's selling jerseys. I mean, it's a click-based economy. That is why it's happening. I promise you that. If you look at like you're saying, the headlines of the beat stories, Lonzo might go 2 for 9, but it's Halloween, you know, because Lonzo happened to play on Halloween. God. You know, like that stuff happens. And
I might quit the podcast. Everybody's
guilty of it. Hey, you can't even pretend like we're not guilty of it. We came up with LeBron's over the summer. I'm going to take credit for that. But
we're guilty of that?
Okay, I'm guilty of that. But it's true. I mean, he is, from a phenomenon standpoint, unlike any of these other rookies, including Ben Simmons. And I've been the one who's saying, hey, we should hype up Ben Simmons a lot more. Lonzo is still getting way more talk than Ben Simmons.
You're right.
Unfairly so. But it all goes back to the fact that he's a cash cow. He's a click, you know, he's a click machine. And I think it's going to take a while for that to wear off. And it may never wear off. I mean, it may take, you know, two straight really bad years, which may never come in his career, because I still think he's going to be a really good player, for people to finally like give up the hope of Lonzo. I mean, what it actually reminds me of in a certain way is Jeremy Lin, because people were milking Jeremy Lin for years after Lin's sanity. I mean, remember when he went to the Rockets? Remember when he went to the Lakers? Like every time he changed teams, there was like a new round of hype, like, oh, Lin's going to be the real deal. Finally, like four teams later, and unfortunately for him, you know, a pretty serious injury this year, we finally, you know, dispensed with that cyclical hype. But I think that's sort of what's awaiting Lonzo here for the foreseeable future.
And I'm just saying that I don't think the team is doing him any favors by feeding the beast. And the Lin example is actually a good one, because I think I would have had a lot more fun watching Lin's career if I didn't have people trying to tell me that this was like the Asian Steve Nash. Like he's a good player, fun player, but he wasn't like some transcendent talent. And so like the disconnect there got frustrating, but
well, you know, that just reminded me of, you know, you were calling me out earlier for the Cousins thing, because I was like the wet blanket after his big game. So Lin hits that game winner during the middle of Lin's sanity. I was in Portland, I was in the media room, and everyone's freaking out, and for whatever reason I did not plan to do this, but I was like, he'll never be, like in the middle of it, like this is like peak Lin sanity. He hits a game-winning three-pointer. The whole media room explodes. Nobody can believe it. And then like once it quiets down, I was like, he'll never be better than a third guard. And everybody looks at me like I committed a war crime. I'm not even kidding. There was no reason for me to say that. Nobody had asked for my opinion. I just kind of broke that out and, well,
never ever change. Of course you were the one person who did not enjoy Lin's sanity. That's fantastic. All right, couple podium questions here. Toby says, an avocado this evening was $3.50 in Sydney, Australia. Recently, a multimillionaire told millennials here that if we didn't eat smashed avocado on toast so often, we would all be able to own a house. You basically can't get a decent house within 2 hours of the city of Sydney for less than a cool million. That's the story. So for anyone who did not listen to the last podcast, that is the explanation for the Matthew Dellavedova question. And
but does it really explain it though? Because is Dellavedova eating avocado toast like as a sign of support for all the millennials who can't buy houses in Australia, or is he just eating it because he likes avocado on toast?
We don't know. I am just personally heartened to know that the housing market is as hopeless for Australians as it is for many Americans, because Australia has a lot of things going for it between weather, attractive people, sensible gun laws. Like the Australia seems like a fun place, but I'm glad that there and here it seems impossible to own a house. So at least we're even on that front.
We were kind of right. I mean, I think I said an avocado might be $45 in Australia, but it was $350. That's still significantly higher than we pay here in California. So I think there is some sort of an exchange rate going on there.
I haven't bought an avocado in my entire life, but I have bought Taco Bell. And our next question is Taco Bell related. Jake says, I figured Ben shouldn't have all the fun with people emailing him their player national parks comparisons, so I decided to compare a few players to something Andrew loves, Taco Bell. For the record, I completely agreed with his Taco Bell take. So a couple examples here. LeBron James, he says, is a cheesy gordita crunch. Total package and could be ordered or win MVP every time. Does many things well and was the natural evolution of past greatness. Giannis, he says, is the Locos Fiesta 9-layer taco supreme, something we have just never seen before. Kawhi Leonard is a soft taco, soft-spoken but carries a big stick, extremely fundamentally sound, and a favorite among real junkies. Might quietly be the best item on the menu. Russell Westbrook, Quesarito. MVP candidate in my book, but I recognize its flaws. Amazing combination of size and skill. A little aggressive. Completely fills the calorie stat sheet, but some argue they could be empty calories. Doesn't necessarily make the rest of your order better. Is it better to do one thing perfectly or multiple things pretty good? John Wall, he says, is a Crunchwrap supreme. Definitely an all-star, close to breaking through his tortilla ceiling to becoming an MVP candidate. And Dion Waiters is a Mexican pizza. Polarizing. The people that love Mexican pizza love it passionately and are irrationally vocal about it. Have you ever eaten at Taco Bell, Ben?
Stop trying to throw these questions to me when they're clearly geared towards you. I know you've got the entire 15 menu item combinations in your head and you're ready to come back at Jake with your own comp. So just go for it. No. Yes, I've eaten at Taco Bell. I'm a big chalupa guy, or at least I was 10 years ago back in my insane days of youth. But the people want to hear your comps, man.
I don't really have comps. I don't have a national parks rant loaded up here. I do have a confession, though. This was a phenomenal email. There were four or five other comps thrown in there. My problem is that I order the exact same thing from Taco Bell every single time I go, and my order is 3 soft tacos and 2 double-deckers, sometimes 3 double-deckers if I'm feeling exceptionally fat on that day. But, and basically because Taco Bell is so rare and I almost never see one, I can't afford to experiment whenever I see one. And the double decker, have you ever had a double decker before?
I have. I mean, this is how I came up with the peanut butter taco, was experiencing the double decker Taco Bell commercials as a child.
You remember the double decker commercials though, right?
Of course.
All right. So that's the thing. The double decker is one of the least appealing things on Taco Bell's menu. I will admit that outright. But I started eating double deckers when I was like 9 or 10 years old in 1996, when Shaq and Hakeem Olajuwon had double decker commercials on TV during like the NBA playoffs. And I just had to have one, tried it then, and have stayed loyal for the rest of my life. I might be the only person who goes to Taco Bell and orders a double decker. But I will be irate one day when they take it off the menu. But yeah, it all started with Shaq and Hakeem Olajuwon. So that's one way to tie it back to basketball.
That was a thoroughly nauseating trip down memory lane. I could actually feel my stomach turn a little bit as we got deeper and deeper to this Taco Bell conversation. I do have one other tie into the NBA though with Taco Bell, and I wonder if you agree about this. This could be an outsider's mistaken perspective, but isn't Taco Bell kind of like interchangeable in a way where they basically just have 5 ingredients and they just throw them together in different combinations and call it different things, like whether you fry it or whether it's soft or whatever. I mean, it's basically lettuce, meat, cheese, diced tomatoes. That's, you know, every single menu item, isn't it? Like, he was listing off these Fiesta 9 layer and quesarito, and to be honest, I pulled a Sharp halfway through and I just started tuning out every single thing you read because you trimmed his list of like 20 down to like 18 and a half or something like that. But isn't it all basically the same thing? It's just all about the delivery mechanism. They're only changing the delivery mechanism.
So you could argue that that's true of Mexican food generally, and that in fact Taco Bell deviates by adding like other unhealthy shit to their menu.
Like Fritos and Doritos?
Yeah, and eggs and stuff. But I do. I really like that take that Mexican food was the original interchangeable.
Well, that's why I'm here. Can we please talk about something else?
Yeah, no. It's time to wrap it up. We will be back Friday. Thank you for all your Taco Bell feedback and avocado info. And yeah, we'll be back Friday. We got to talk about Ben Simmons and a bunch of other things. So send us your questions. And thank you, Ben. Talk to you soon, man.
openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Send us your questions, comments, concerns, and food recommendations for fast food. Even though Andrew describes Taco Bell like he lives in Mongolia, like he comes across it once every 5,000 miles, I don't understand
That's
why.
How it feels.
They're pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. Take it easy, man.
All right, 5-star reviews. I'll talk to you.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.